Welcome to Loud and Clear, a podcast dedicated to amplifying the voices of women in music. I'm your host, Olivia Adams, and welcome to our series called YXE Divas, the artistic voices behind the Saskatoon Symphony Orchestra's upcoming show. As part of this series, I am interviewing each of the solo artists featured in this show, and we're releasing episodes as a lead up to the big event. Today, it is my pleasure to chat with the leader on the podium herself, hailed by critics as charismatic, crisp, precise, and elegant. Yana Saylor has firmly established herself as a conductor, violinist, and groundbreaking visionary on the Canadian music scene. Originally from rural Saskatchewan, Yana completed her studies in violin and conducting at the Brandon School of Music and the University of British Columbia. She recently listed on the Women in Music Canada's Honor Roll 10 Female Artists to Watch in March of 2023 and is the winner of the Betty Webster Award for Orchestral Innovation from Orchestras Canada. Yana combines diverse experiences on the international stage with a deep sense of community, equality, and social justice. Her creative output is firmly rooted in the conviction that classical music should be inclusive and accessible to all. This guiding principle has led Yana to work on a number of arts-based social initiatives, including music instruction for disadvantaged youth in downtown Vancouver's East Side, fundraising and outreach activities for immigrants, establishing music therapy programs, and the founding of Allegro Chamber Orchestra, an all-female professional ensemble with a social action mandate to champion the works of female minority artists and to enact change through music. Highlights for Yana in 2024 include presenting at the International Conductor Guild Conference in New York, as well as the Global Leaders Institute Innovation Summit in Peru. In January, Yana conducts the debut of Indigenous Divas, Indigenous Stories, and Opera Hilts in Vancouver with Allegro Chamber Orchestra and with guest artist Marion Newman and the Calgary Philharmonic Orchestra. Yana leads the Saskatoon Symphony in YXE Divas, showcasing local female artists in pop, rock, blues, jazz, and returns to conduct torch songs with Julie Nasralla with the Saskatoon Symphony. Yana has conducted major orchestras and ensembles, including the Ottawa Symphony Orchestra, Calgary Philharmonic, Symphony Nova Scotia, Kingston Symphony, Brat Festival, National Academy Orchestra, Winnipeg Symphony, Edmonton Symphony, Vancouver Symphony, Vancouver Philharmonic Orchestra, Vancouver Intercultural Orchestra, Kensington Symphonia, Saskatoon Symphony, Regina Symphony, Symphony New Brunswick, and Société de Musique Contemporaine de Québec. Active as a concert producer, Yana's work can be seen on stages across Canada and heard on the airways as a producer for CBC Calgary. Welcome. How are you?
Hi, Olivia. I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me again.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you back. You're our first repeat guest, so I'm very excited to chat with you again.
Oh, I'm so delighted.
And I wondered, can you let us know, what have you been up to this last year? It's been a year since you've been on the podcast, but you've had a very busy 2023. What's been going on in your musical world?
Wow. Yeah. Time flies, doesn't it? Well, I guess a highlight so far of 2024 has been the launch of my project that I've been working on with some incredible collaborators called Indigidivas. And this is a project that's been 3 years in the making. This features three Indigenous opera singers singing in many cases in Indigenous languages or telling Indigenous stories through music, through the operatic medium. Many of these pieces were either written specifically for us or for the artists or are, excerpted from existing Indigenous opera. And so we premiered it first in Vancouver with the Allegro Chamber Orchestra, my orchestra, which is all female identifying orchestra. And actually Indigidivas was incubated within kind of that, the safety net of Allegra. And we did a number of workshops and so it was only fitting that we launch it with that in-house orchestra. And then it is a show that is made to travel and can be transferred to other communities. And so our next stop was the Calgary Philharmonic. And we performed the same show with a few additions. We added the wonderful soloist, mezzo-soprano Marion Newman, and, featured some more Alberta-based content, which was really wonderful. And so it was really cool to see that project that had been in the works and living in our hearts and our minds for so long, to see that launched out into the world, and then also to see the audience response to it, which was overwhelmingly positive, and the music is just powerful. It's beautiful. You know, it addresses some of these challenges, some of these struggles, these ongoing historical inequities and injustices, but the music is so beautiful. It carries it, and it carries that message, and it carries it in a way that brings a lot of healing. So, which was really central to kind of our concept of the show, that we didn't want to, of course, there's sadness, but we didn't want to stay in the sadness. We wanted to acknowledge that and then move forward. So that's been just an incredibly powerful part of not only my musical journey, but my life, and working with the wonderful artists, Melody Courage, soprano, Rebecca Cuddy, mezzo soprano, Michelle Lafferty, also mezzo soprano and composer. So that felt like a really tremendous effort to launch that out into the world. And yeah, well, you know, busy working with orchestras as a guest conductor, I feel really honored and blessed to be able to work with ensembles, you know, around Canada. And I've just returned from the UK. Really always so rewarding to be able to work with these and tremendous learning always. I try to always just be open and receptive to what each of these ensembles offers and what's going on within their sphere. And that's really cool and really interesting to kind of just drop in. And actually, I don't know if I told you this, but I'm doing an MBA through the Global Leaders Institute.
Amazing.
And just to add an extra
you're not busy enough
complication. Yeah. But it's been amazing. It's specific to arts innovation, which is and the cohort of 60 amazing artist creators, curators from all over the world. And it's all online. And we come together for in-person practicums and summits. So a couple times throughout the degree. And this is part of my strategy, maybe ties into what you want to talk about. But my strategy to become a really integrated music director that has a really innate knowledge of industry and the business workings. Because I think in the years to come, a lot more is going to be expected of music directors, just with the state of the arts, where we're going, just the complications that we see, trying to, you know, honing my own leadership skills, my own knowledge, and just going deeper to make sure that, you know, my skills can serve the music and my organizations moving forward. It means a lot of late nights and doing homework backstage, and sometimes I really regret this life choice.
I feel you there. Doing the PhD, also working full time. It's, you know, it's a time. I'd really love to talk today about the business behind the music, because what maybe people don't realize as enjoyers of music is that our days are not only spent practicing or like touring, you know, people that tour or, you know, doing interviews and things like that. That's the fun stuff, you know, the rehearsing. But then there's this sort of tedious end of being a musician. And that includes the marketing and the grant writing and the reaching out for opportunities and the applying to all of the things that you need to apply to get into the music industry. So I wondered if we could talk a little bit more about that today.
Oh yeah, no, it's one of my favorite topics, and that I think is not covered in most music programs. Hopefully we'll see some changes in that in the coming years. But really, really valuable skills. You can be really, really talented, but if you don't have kind of those back-end skills of how to promote yourself, how to get yourself out there. You know, I've seen some really talented people that nobody knows about, or they're not able to make themselves, you know, create these opportunities for themselves.
Yeah. And I think that it's going to start to change in universities and music programs. Like, I'm hopeful for that. I think I took like a half semester course. Like, it was covered in the pedagogy curriculum on like running your business. And I was like, well, but, you know, those 6 weeks necessarily sufficient. And it was lots of questions. And we've had different business people on the podcast before, but it is something that's sort of unique to being a musician, is that you're also a business manager until you can get a manager.
Yeah, absolutely.
So as a conductor, how do you decide what opportunities to take and what to decline and what you have the capacity for? Because you are, you know, the resident conductor for Allegro Chamber Orchestra, but you also do a whole lot of guest conducting, right? Your approach to be a conductor. And then how do you decide, what do I have time for and what needs my attention more or less.
Yeah, absolutely. This is an ongoing struggle for me. So I by no means have it figured out. But I mean, I'm kind of trying to learn from my mistakes early on, where I just took on absolutely everything. And then, you know, you're overwhelmed and perhaps underprepared, or you've taken on things that, you know, aren't, you, perhaps you're not ready for. Or as I work more in the industry, you know, you realize what your strengths are. And you know, that there's repertoire, things that you are your strengths and what that you really specialize in. And then, you know, things that if you weren't aware yourself, though, or, you know, the orchestra will point out to you where your weaknesses are. So, you know, it's always that fine balance of taking on things that, you know, showcase your strengths while you work on your other things that, you know, perhaps you have less experience in or less of a comfort level with certain kinds of repertoire, for example. Like for myself, like I specialize in new music. Then that's my happy place, things that other people just run away screaming from. I love the complex meter changes, and like I love the puzzle. I love working with the living composers. I love things that are obscure and abstract. That's my happy place. It lights up my brain. Whereas, you know, other folks, for example, that their strength is the, you know, maybe perhaps the romantic and more traditional, what we think of more traditional classical repertoire. Whereas, you know, I can do that, but like I said, new music is my happy place, and I feel confident that I can walk in and work with an ensemble in that way. Whereas some of the more traditional repertoire, I have to dig a little bit deeper and work a little bit harder. And there are other people that are just amazing at it. And so I stand in awe of them. So now I'm starting to make that decision of what can I bring? Can I be of service to the ensemble with what I bring to this at this time? I was offered some Messiahs very early on in my career. And that is a piece that I absolutely, you know, revere. Actually, it got canceled because of COVID. And I'm actually kind of thankful for that, because once I dove in, like to really dig into my prep, I realized I was like, wow, I really haven't lived with this enough as a conductor. I've played it, I don't know how many times as a violinist, but as a conductor, it's a whole different thing. There's you're making a lot of decisions that will impact a lot of people, and you have to have your reasons for it. You know, now that I've lived with it a little bit longer, I would feel much better about it. It'd still be my maiden voyage. You know, so these works that that are huge, you know, you live with them for your lifetime. And I mean, one of the amazing things about being a conductor is it's a lifetime apprenticeship. Because these music is constantly humbling and teaching you. And so, you know, anytime you encounter one of these major symphonies or major works for the first time, it's terrifying and incredible and exhilarating and all those things to always dreamed of when you hear this music that we all love. So more and more I'm saying to, you know, if I get something that I feel it doesn't fit me, I'm passing that on and with the recommendation of someone. My esteemed colleagues that, yes, I can do this, but this person is really the best for it, because ultimately we have to be thinking about bigger picture. We have to be thinking of what's best for the industry, because the industry is fragile, as we've seen. Every opportunity that we have to be on the podium and work with an ensemble and you know, create music in a community is a tremendous privilege, and we can't take any of that for granted. And so the more and more I want to make sure that I'm putting my absolute best foot forward. And then also, you know, there's some things, you know, perhaps pop shows that, you know, I've had my run of pop shows, and I do love me a pop show, but you know, there's some that it's a huge opportunity. I could open up a huge opportunity for one of my younger colleagues, and you know, it would just be another day at the office for me, but it could be really something extraordinary for someone else. So there are things like that I also try to consider when I have that opportunity.
Mm-hmm. That's great. I've been talking with some of the artists for the YXC Divas show, who a lot of them work independently and are sort of navigating this post-COVID world in which performance venues are coming back, concerts are coming back, but it looks different than it did before, and there's still lots of hesitation to come out. And I'm just wondering, what does it look like, especially in this sort of, now that things are back to normal, you know, in quotation marks, in this sort of newer iteration of music performance, what does it look like to advertise, to market yourself as a conductor before you have that orchestral position? Like, I'm specifically thinking of those that are sort of moving out of masters and DMA programs or are starting to try to get their footing in this realm of being a conductor, what does that look like?
Yeah, well, I think in some ways, COVID was a mixed blessing in that it showed us how capable we can be mm-hmm. in creating our own content. And, you know, I hate the word pivot, but how, you know, how yeah. we could transfer those skills to other things. And, you know, just those, the innate personal growth that we've gone through as being musicians and, you know, working at things and being adaptable. And we could mm-hmm. transfer those to in other ways for our own kind of resilience. But we do have more opportunities now than ever. I mean, it's a mixed bag because there's so much noise, there's so much going on, you know, in the online sphere, but we do have ways of making our own content and kind of making ourselves the expert in our field, or, you know, offering up what we have to our communities and to the music industry through, you know, different modes. I think more and more I'm encouraging folks that are coming out of the traditional school system to really hone in and find what their niche is, what their passion is. Because, I mean, that's almost solely what my career is based on, is that I'm known as a specialist in female and minority composers, and that I can conduct those things, and that orchestras can come to me and help them program their season in a respectful and balanced way. And so that was something that was just born out of my own passion, and then I started creating things around it. And so, I mean, I'd never sought out consciously to do that. I realized I saw gaps in the repertoire, and I was discovering things that I wanted to perform. And so I had to find a way of doing it. So it started off very small. You know, we can all be entrepreneurs in our little corner. I mean, I started doing just house concert series with some friends, and this couple had just bought their dream home, and they were thrilled to have musicians making music in their home. And when, you know, so it started off very, very small like that, and, you know, programming some weird stuff that, like, thankfully these audiences were very receptive to. And so that was kind of the beginning that I started doing that during my master's. And that was kind of the beginning of figuring out, getting my feet wet with promoting my own things, just on a very small, very safe way to my mm-hmm. immediate community. And, you know, you have to do those things to build your confidence and learn as you go. And then, you know, I started writing grants and connecting with others that were doing similar things, and, you know, doing co-productions. And, you know, so it can happen very organically that way. But I don't think you can skip over any of those steps in confidence building yeah. and kind of learning the ropes of how audiences work and how organizing a rehearsal schedule and working with if you're working with a composer, how that works and how those deadlines work and how commissioning works. You can't really kind of skip over any of those steps, I don't think. So it's good to maybe start small and start with something you're really passionate about, because people respond to that, I think, like a legitimate passion. And there's so many ways that you can share it now, like on social media or Twitch or whatever. You can have a podcast, you can create a podcast, you can create a blog. I had a blog for a while, and I really enjoyed that. I don't know if blogs are in Invite Reads blogs anymore, but that was something that, you know, that worked for me. I just talked about my experiences, and it's a really brutally honest, it's still up there, it's a really brutally honest kind of unfiltered reflections on some things. But that was part of my process. I don't know if I would do that now, but that was what I did then, and it helped me, and also get comfortable putting myself out there. That's the other thing. And there were blog posts that I put up, and then I promptly took back down again. I was like, I don't know if I'm ready for that, or to assert my opinions this strongly. And so that was also there's a kind of a personal growth aspect to it, I think, also, when you're stepping out there to promote yourself, because it is you. It's your truest you showing up in your truest yeah. when you are creating something or putting yourself out there, even just, you know, trying to get conducting jobs. You have to be that authentic self and have built yourself up on confidence that only you can do.
Yeah. And I mean, I sort of hate the terminology of, like, market yourself, but that's sort of like what we've come to in this entrepreneurial space. And, like, I like how you said, like, it can come organically and it can come authentically, and that's going to probably be your best source of action, right? And that you can't skip the, I like that you said, you can't skip those steps, right? That it's a process, and there's lots of learning that happens on that journey. I mean, I know that I sort of got into the space that I'm in music and very, very early on in my career. But when I was in my undergrad, I was like, well, I want to just play gender balanced programs. That was my goal, was that, like, whenever I played a recital, I played gender balanced programs. And then it sort of went from there, right? And now I get to host a podcast with wonderful people like yourself talking about gender and music industry. But it came from like a very authentic place of, I'm not learning about any women in music history or in music theory, so I'm just going to play them in my programming.
Breadcrumbs that are along the way. Yeah.
Exactly. And now I can like look back and I was like, there was a very organic path to get to where I'm, you know, going to host a podcast on gender and music and, you know, write books on gender and music. But there is that path. One author I listened to, she said, I'm the longest overnight success. She's like, that. And I was like, that's super fair.
Yeah.
Well, when you're talking about putting yourself out there and starting to get booking to hopefully, I mean, most conductors, I would say now tend to work with agents, but you have to have that proven track record. How do you as a conductor go about getting booked with an agent and what does that look like?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't be the one to know. Because I've tried to get booked with agents, and this was pre-COVID, and you know, we were having some discussions, and I was on good terms with some. They said, you know what? Yeah, well, we don't have capacity right now, but when we do, well, you know, we'll add you to our roster, or we had a conversation and we determined that they were just not quite the right fit. They didn't have the right connections for me. And then I was very fortunate to receive some awards and some recognition earlier this year, and then I had an agency approach me, and now I'm represented by them. So and that's a good fit. Mm-hmm. So as far as actually going about and promoting yourself to an agent, I mean, what I did was just make sure I had really good materials at hand. Everything was really updated. I had someone else go over my bio. It's impossible to write your own bio. Have someone write your bio. Also, probably mostly because you won't give yourself enough credit and you don't see the extraordinary things, the things that you know, really jump out at other people when they encounter you. So get someone else to write your bio. Keep it up to date and keep all your materials up to date. You know, create a nice portfolio that's just ready to go. And then also have, for conductors especially, it's really important to have really good videos of yourself conducting. And that actually is a very tricky thing even now, because I, you know, I still need materials to promote myself for things. And, you know, a lot of North American orchestras are unionized and you can't video yourself, because they, rightfully so, they have regulations around that, and you have to pay out the orchestra to use that material in many cases. It depends on their collective agreement. That is an ongoing challenge of getting quality material. So I mean, that was one of the nice bonuses about working in the UK, because all I had to do was get permission, and now I have some lovely video of me conducting in this amazing cathedral where the acoustics were absolutely whack. So I haven't edited the video, the audio. Apparently it sounded good in the audience, but from where we were, like, the sound just bounced everywhere. Anyways, that's an aside. But I remember when I was starting early on, I saved up my pennies and I hired some folks and, you know, have them sign off on a thing. That's very important if you're going to use any content, and to have their agreement. And, you know, the camera zeroed in on me, and I paid them to play for me. And I got some video that way. I mean, that was a long time ago, but sometimes you have to, you invest in yourself that way to have quality materials, because, you know, it's not, you can present yourself, you know, conducting a pianist or at a workshop or something, but, you know, want to try and give yourself credit and present yourself the best way that you can. So always having your materials up to date and looking nice, and, you know, having actual professionally done photos goes a long way. You know, we can do amazing things with iPhones, but still working with a professional photographer and a stylist that can just give you that boost, because we're such a visual society. We make snap judgments. So the more, I hate to kind of play into that, but you do kind of have to give yourself an advantage of presenting yourself really well visually, and give yourself every advantage possible that way to present yourself really, really well.
Yeah. When you're talking about materials specifically, for anyone out there listening who has not updated their CV, keep that CV up to date. What else do you put in your portfolio? The repertoire that you specialize in? What else?
Yeah, actually, that was something I forgot to mention is, everything you conduct, keep it listed. Keep a running list of this, because it's really, really hard to go back and call it after the fact. Yeah, keep an up-to-date repertoire list. I update mine monthly because I add new stuff. So it's, I don't know, it's pages and pages now. And then when, you know, when someone asks me to submit my repertoire, I'm like, okay, here you go. have fun. But I do have organized it in the last couple of months in a way that I think highlights more what I do. So I have a segment on Canadian composers organized according to Canadian repertoire, minority composers, you know, other 21st century rep, and then, you know, more traditional rep, concerti, you know, chamber orchestra, full orchestra, so that people can kind of see, you know, if you look at my repertoire list, you can tell what kind of conductor I am. You know, that the new music portion of it is like 10 pages, and, you know, the more traditional rep, more like 3 to 5.
Right.
And keeping track of, you know, I've conducted on a lot of albums, so making sure that's on there. And that goes for any instrumentalist as well, you know, list the recordings that you've played on. That tells a lot about what kind of musician you are. And, you know, things that you've assisted. For myself, you know, there are some operas that I assisted on, so I made sure to list that. But also, you have to be honest. If you haven't conducted it in performance, you just say study only or assisted only, because it's the whole thing, you know, that meme that goes around that's like, you know, you lied on your resume and like now you've been thrown in. And you know, I mean, the flip side of that is I've also, you know, been thrown in or had to fill in at last minute and had to just rise to that challenge. So, you know, not to say that you're not capable of conducting that big rep on short notice, but you don't want to give off that impression that you're, in my opinion, you know, that you've conducted Mahler 4 and you've just assisted on it.
Right. Yeah. No, that's really good. Just keeping those materials up to date so that when the opportunity arises, that you're ready and you're prepared for it. I know a lot of musicians that are very uncomfortable talking about money, but I think that it is an important thing to talk about because a lot of us are independent contractors. And I'm wondering if you can talk to approaches to setting fees as an independent contractor. What does that look like? And, you know, because you want to set a fee that in which you're able to live and make music, but also like you don't want to undercut the industry and you want to pay respect to the organizations that you're working with and to your colleagues in the field. So what does that look like?
Yeah, well, I mean, in some ways it's for unionized musicians, it's a bit easier because we do mm-hmm. have that scale that is outlined. And so I've even had to, early on when orchestras kind of lowball me, I'd be like, actually, I can't work for that little.
Yeah.
I actually can't. And here's why. And, you know, very politely, and just be like, are you aware of the tariff of fees? Because, you know, fair enough, all orchestras are pinched for dollars always. And I was a young conductor starting off, and it was a good opportunity for me. But, you know, I did have to be paid union minimum. And so I had to educate them a little bit, which felt a little bit strange, to be honest. But they did actually pay me more than the minimum, union minimum, I don't know, out of embarrassment or something. So there are things like that you can fall back on, you know. And this is, I can encounter this a lot, you know, when I was a violinist working full-time and, you know, working for different jobs that were, you know, not union. So we do have that to fall back on. But when you know, you do have to kind of set your personal standards. But also, I'm willing to work with anyone that wants to work with me. Like, I have a sliding scale, so if it's, you know, a smaller organization that relies on grant funding and fundraising and is like hustling, because I think some of these smaller organizations are doing some of the most interesting work out there. So I'm happy to work with, you know, a little indie opera company and perhaps would negotiate with them and work a little bit more with them to see what can fit their budget. And mm-hmm. as I understand how grants work and how it's a fixed amount, how to work within that. And or because there's other ways of negotiating too, like I can negotiate in that I can take video or, you know, use mm-hmm. things like that. Yeah. So even if it's not monetary, to make sure that everyone, and really it can be very awkward to have these conversations. And now I'm actually very, very happy to have an agent to pass most of these off. But because it is my least favorite. But, you know, in a way, having an agent has given me a new perspective, just be like, no, this is not extravagant. You've trained your whole life for this. You have 3 degrees, you know, like they're just very cut and dried. And they'll be like, this is how much this artist is making, so you should make at least that much. And this is what you bring to the table. So it's been like an interesting perspective shift there, because ultimately we do have to be paid in order to continue the art form. So, but I think for myself, yeah, I'm flexible. I will work with the smaller companies and the regional orchestras if they want to work with me for something that will work for them, but also work for me that I'm comfortable with. And then also walking away when it just won't work and be like, you know mm-hmm. what? I have a colleague that would love to do this, and you know, this would be a great fee pay range for them, but just a number of things that I have on my plate, it's not practical. Right. And you just leave it at that, and find them a solution. I try to, if I have to walk away from something, I always try to leave them with a solution. So, and then, you know, obviously larger orchestras, they have larger budgets, larger audiences, larger donor base, all of those things. So the fee is in accordance with that. So, but it can be very tricky. It can be very uncomfortable. And also, as once again, like a personal growth thing, a personal value thing. Do I believe that I should be paid well? And do I believe in my skills? Do I believe that I have something to offer that should be compensated? Yeah. So I think for a lot of folks, especially musicians, there's also still like this weird thing hanging around that it's an art form and art should be free. We should just be willing to donate our art. And you know, of course, that's not practical. And then I used to donate my time a lot when I had that time to, but now I'm very strategic about the time that I donate, because, you know, oftentimes I was donating my time at the expense of myself or working on my own skills or things. So, and, you know, I try to make a point of donating some of my time and energy and talent, but I do it strategically, and I only do it where I know it's actually valued, because sometimes that's the thing too, is if you're being underpaid, but you know that you're valued and treated well, that's one thing. But if, even if you're being paid well, but you're not being valued or treated well in the context, you know, there's that human payoff that either takes or gives.
Yeah. And, you know, as much as people would like art to be free, it isn't free for the humans that are performing or expressing that art. And I mean, I've seen like, there's those memes that go around on social media of somebody that's looking up just in the sky, and they're like, if my the roof over my head, if I lived on exposure alone, because that is, it's not a reality, and we do deserve to be compensated. And I like that idea too. If there is no wiggle room on that fee, can you negotiate for something else, like getting video? I know I did that when an organization asked me to perform a concert. It was lower than my usual fee. And I was like, I would like X number of tickets. I would like my meals covered, and I sort of negotiated other things. Can I have an extra XYZ for this coverage, to be able to sort of make up for some of that, that fact? Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, usually they're happy to try and accommodate things like that.
You know,
if they, you know, in most cases when I've been paid or accepted less, they're like, they were very much aware that it was below. And because that's also an awareness thing. It's like, if you make that below industry standard or below, but I'm willing to work with you under these circumstances, then you know, it can be a good reciprocal thing and kind of transform that situation from like not getting paid.
And oftentimes those organizations are grateful to be made aware of that, and will seek out extra funding for their continuing season or what have you. But it is, it's good to be aware. It's like, this is below industry standard, but here's how we can, you know, accommodate. And there's that reciprocity. And I'm wondering, a lot of symphonies are switching to the model of conducting residencies rather than tenured conducting positions. And what has your experience with that been? And how do you see that changing the field?
Yeah, well, absolutely. Even since COVID, there's a lot, at least in my circles, there are fewer conducting opportunities, fewer jobs, as, you know, orchestras either tighten their belts or get rid of, you know, their assistant conductor positions, or don't fill them, or don't fill their MD positions, what have you. So that's been interesting to navigate, for sure, that there's just seems to be fewer jobs in Canada and in North America, where I primarily work. But I think from the orchestra's perspective, I think it's really positive, because, you know, there's this whole thing where the conductor gets up and they've been doing the same thing for years and years, and the orchestra stops paying attention, or familiarity breeds contempt. And unless the conductor is really conscious of building their skills and evolving the orchestra, it can just start to feel, for the industry, it can start to stagnate a little bit. And even I've seen this even just with massively successful conductors that I've either assisted or just been in close contact with, that, you know, have wonderful things to offer, but just, it can be really difficult somehow. And I haven't figured this out, to maintain that freshness and keep bringing new things to the orchestra. They, you know, they become intimately acquainted with your strengths and your jokes and your weaknesses. And so I think that it is a really positive thing to not have music directors that set up shop for, you know, 10 years at a time. I think for a very traditional industry, it is kind of shaking things up in like how we structure things. But I think it's ultimately very positive because, like I said earlier, in order for the orchestra to grow, one conductor can't specialize in every repertoire. And so I think that it's really important for the orchestra to see a lot of different faces that will help them to grow in different ways and introduce mm-hmm. different things and still have some continuity, and, you know, because orchestras can develop bad habits, and, you know, there's things that need to be built and established, and, you know, reinforcing kind of the leadership models and affirming the principles and the things that they do, and that can come from, you know, seeing a conductor more regularly. But I think it's really important for music directors that have been in the position to really take a hard look at it at themselves and make sure that they're evolving, make sure that they're evolving their ensemble and that they're bringing in the people to help with that. And I don't think that's happening enough, or has been happening right. enough in the past. So then you get an orchestra that just sounds the same no matter what repertoire they're playing, you know, because that's just how the conductor yeah. conducts. Yeah. You know, that's no judgment, but there's very few music directors that can kind of maintain freshness and bring different things. And I think the ones that are is because they're directly challenging themselves to grow and to really dig into these different aspects of their conducting. And because I think a lot of things, there's a lot of stagnation in orchestras because of the 10-year model, where people just get, you know, are fortunate enough to win that position, which is really hard, and then they just kind of camp out there, and then there's not a lot of upward trajectory. Like, that's not even possible in the orchestra. So you have to take a lot of personal responsibility for your professional development, which can be very difficult in an orchestra where, you know, you audition for first violin, fourth chair, and that's where you stay. Like, you know, it's not like you can have an upward trajectory and like a corporate world or something. If you work really hard, practice really hard, then you can move up. It doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
So I think that that's something that's really challenging. And even in the opera orchestra that I played with, where we would rotate positions, even between sections, there was still that stagnation, you know, unless, like I said, people take really personal responsibility for their playing and pursuing things outside to make sure that they're growing. And we do this with Allegra. You know, we've started to have professional development sessions on different things. And so the orchestra already has to do a lot as far as, you know, maintaining programming and audience relationships and all the future planning. It's a lot. But I think there is a bit of a piece missing as far as like personal and professional development within the organizations, that, like, even for the conductors who are at the top in working on their leadership skills, working on their technique. There needs to be another piece there, because this is kind of going off on a side road here, but, you know, the stats for like job satisfaction among orchestras is very, very low.
Okay.
And there's some pretty shocking data on that that Orchestras Canada can supply. And it's directly linked to the fact that people, lack of upward trajectory, lack of agency within the orchestra, that all lead to a lot of internal professional struggles.
Right. Yeah, that's really interesting. And I think that at least in Canada, classical music has taken a hard look at it. At itself with the shutting down of the KW Symphony, and what does that future look like? And I think that you are absolutely correct in that we need that continuing development and the continuing to refine, because it's not, like you said, it's not a corporate world where we're sort of trying to climb this hypothetical ladder, right? But that it's about sort of refining our craft individually as musicians. That's really great. Well, before we wrap up with our rapid fire questions, I wonder if we could end here. And what role do you believe, or do you believe, that conductors play a role in shaping the future of classical music?
Well, you know, like it or not, and we are put in this position of leadership, of authority, until we kind of change up the whole structure of the orchestra. We do call a lot of the shots, and I think that there's some really interesting things happening within the orchestra structure that's, I think, is really healthy, really good, in that, you know, we're seeing a lot more player-led orchestras, or they're bringing in conductors that they want to see, that they want to be led by, you know, that are more committee-led, which I think is great, because I I think, you know, there was the age of the conductor having like supreme power and say over the repertoire. That's definitely passed, and that doesn't work anymore. And I hope that organizations are seeing that we need a lot more input, a lot more, especially with a lot of the, I mean, I have wonderful, lovely colleagues from all over the world that lead Canadian orchestras that I have all the love and respect for, but they have big jobs elsewhere, and they're not necessarily integrated into the community, so they can't necessarily make the best choices for the community. And that's not their fault. You know, they come from a completely different culture. So yes, conductors have a big role to play, but I think that they also need to make sure that they're listening to their communities, listening to orchestras, listening to their artists that they work with in the orchestra, because it really depends on the structure of the organization. Because some organizations, the MD still has carte blanche on what goes on. And, you know, that's not necessarily, you can kind of tell actually, like when you look at the programming and in some cases where you look at the audience engagement. You know, if they're not, the audience is not sold on what that conductor is peddling, then, you know, you run into issues, especially if they're there for a long period of time. And our world is changing so fast, even just, you know, the population of Canada is changing so fast. The music industry is changing. So the more eyes and ears that we have to have input is really, really important. And classical music, I think in 10 years it's going to look very, very different if it's going to survive. If I don't mean to be dire about this, but if it's going to survive, it's going to have to be much different than it is now. It's going to have to be much more inclusive. It's going to have to be much more integrated into the society, because at least in the Canadian population, you know, last year we welcomed 500,000 immigrants from other countries. And if they don't see themselves reflected on our stages, why would they bother? So there's nothing there for our audiences, then we don't have audiences.
Absolutely.
It was a long road that way.
Orchestras Canada released a really amazing article and research about the state of classical music and what diversity is going to have to, like, I mean, I don't want to use that as a cliche word, but what is going to have to change in order for audiences to continue to pay money.
Yeah.
And I see that in the work that I'm doing in my PhD on adaptive music education. If we're not creating music education that is inclusive of everybody, of all abilities, then we are not going to have a future of students, right? We're like that, because the trends are very much declining unless there is adaption and change that's happening.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I feel like we could talk for a really long time, but we probably need to wrap this up. It's been just such a pleasure getting to chat with you. I'm going to wrap up with a few rapid fire questions. No wrong answers. Go with your gut. These are different from last time, but what is your desert island album?
This is the hardest question for me. And that's usually like, I don't know, if I could make an album of whatever I'm working on at the time, it's like...
Mixtape.
Yeah, exactly. Because the more I dig into the stuff that's in front of me, I'm always mind blown by it, even if I at first completely overwhelmed. So if I could just make a mixtape of whatever the snapshot of what I'm working on right now.
Amazing. Do you have a pre-concert ritual, and what is it?
Well, it's kind of evolved over the years. I used to have a really elaborate one. Now I had to have my yoga mat and, you know, my special essential oils and, you know, and all that stuff is amazing. And if I had time to do that, I would still do my long elaborate ritual. But the reality is you usually have the time backstage is usually very, very tight, and days performance days rarely unfold exactly as you would like them to. But I get my pre-performance ritual. I have hot water with lemon. It's just very calming. And I make sure to just walk out on the stage before anybody's there. And that's kind of like, I feel like the concert hall, when it's quiet, there's just, there's nobody there. And it's just, it's just a beautiful, it's almost like being in a church for me, you know, a beautiful cathedral. And you walk in there and you just feel the space, and you just feel the anticipation of what's going to happen. And you just have a quiet moment and just kind of send good energy into the future, and to the folks that will be streaming in, and to the folks that will be on the stage with me. And so that's, I always try to do that. I have my water and my little moment in church, and then I go and try to sort myself out.
Love it. If you could give one piece of musical advice to a fellow musician out there, what would it be?
Follow your gut, follow your instincts, follow the things that light you up. Those are clues to who you are and what you're supposed to do.
Awesome. Well, thanks for coming on Loud and Clear. Do you mind letting our audience know where they can find you? And I'll link to everything in the show notes.
Oh, absolutely. Thanks so much. Well, you can find me on my sadly outdated website, which is in process. Yana Saylor, JANNASAILOR.com. You can find me on my website or AllegraChamberOrchestra.com.
Amazing. Thanks for coming on and talking with me, and look forward to the show.
Thank you.
All right. And that is a wrap on our YXE Divas series. Yana is the last artist that we had on the podcast in this series. And it was so much fun getting to interview all of the amazing artists for this show. I'm really looking forward to the show that's happening this weekend. But of course, these episodes are evergreen. So if you are listening to this podcast after the YXE Divas show, I hope that you're still learning so much about these incredible cultural leaders, these instructors, teachers, conductors, innovators, and musicians in the music industry in Canada, and who all proudly call Saskatchewan home or have called it home in the past. So because this one is the last episode in the series, that means that we are taking a bit of a break after this series, but fear not, because if you are in Saskatoon, we are going to do our first ever live recording of the podcast, and I'm going to be sitting down at McNally Robinson, which is a local bookstore and cafe that hosts all of the SSO's concert chats. And we are going to be recording and streaming my conversation with Judith Yan. Judith's episode is one of the most downloaded episodes that we have on this podcast. So I'm really looking forward to sitting down with her again. And we are going to be talking about some music programming that's taking place with the SSO and her experience as a conductor. So if you would like to tune in, I will make sure to have all of those details posted before the event. And if you are in Saskatoon, that is happening April 30th at 7 o'clock at McNally Robinson. It is completely free to attend. So I hope to see you there. And I hope that you check out the YXE Divas either on concertstream.tv or in person, and make sure to grab your tickets before Saturday if you're listening to it the week that it releases. It has been such a pleasure to bring this series to you. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll talk to you soon. Bye for now.